I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Memorial Day is just around the corner, and chances are you need some plans for your three-day weekend. Why not a tried-and-true favorite, the movies? Today, the film critics return to review and recommend the latest in indie, foreign, and documentary features now showing on area screens. From the true story about culinary genius Jeremiah Towers' self-imposed exile to a post-apocalyptic fiction of struggle and survival, they'll cover plots of victory and defeat, stories of love and loss. And we'll discuss the decision the Cannes Film Festival has made regarding Netflix. A little something for everyone on Up to Date after this hour's news. Today will range from a film about Emily Dickinson to one about one-time boxer Chuck Wepner and a documentary about a chef who changed the food world. It's a lot to handle in just one show, but we'll see if our film critics are up to it, and I got a feeling they are. Today, our critics are KCUR's Steve Walker. Steven.
Good morning.
Bob Butler reviews movies for the Kansas City Star. You can read his reviews every week at butlerscinemascene.com. Bob, how are you?
Great.
Cindy Haynes is away, so Beck Ireland is back with us one more time here. She's co-founder of the movie review site The Rest is Advertising, and she writes for kcactive.com. And Beck, always good to have you, too. Welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So we're far enough into 2017 to gauge the year we're having, it seems to me. Any early thoughts? Are you happy critics these days, Steve Walker? Miserable critics?
Well,
based on what you're seeing? Summarize the year so far.
I'm usually happy, sometimes miserable.
I've seen both.
Yeah, you have. I was looking at just the other day. It's almost June. We're almost halfway through
right.
the year.
Yeah.
I have maybe four films that I would put on any top 10 list, one of which debuted on Netflix, which we're going to talk about today a little bit, too.
Right.
So is it a good year? I mean, we've got some really good movies we're talking about today. So I think it's a month-by-month thing with this, with you and me and Bob and Beck and the shows.
Yeah. Beck, over time, do movies, are they getting better or are they getting worse? What are you seeing as you survey the landscape and a long number of years watching good movies and not so good movies?
Well, it certainly depends on what kind of movie you're talking about. We're heading into the summer, so we've already started with this huge mega-budget bomb, King Arthur.
Yeah,
you know, I had to sit through that. It was pretty excruciating. But I really do. You know, with this Netflix thing that we're going to be talking about, I feel like it's sort of a new age for filmmakers, possibly in that the studios have sort of gutted their middle filmmakers, but it seems like these streaming services are picking them up, and they get to do some good work with it.
Your point being there's more opportunities for filmmakers than ever before to actually get their work seen out there.
Yeah, I think it's still really hard to come up with the money to make movies. I mean, that's always going to be a struggle. But, with these new channels, I think it's pretty exciting stuff. Even some, famous names are heading to streaming. You know, we've had Woody Allen doing something, and it was just announced today that Pedro Almodovar, the famous Spanish director, is going to be doing a series for Netflix.
Oh, that's amazing. Bob, what are you seeing out there?
You know,
right
Al,
now?
What I'm seeing is what I've always seen. There are always worthwhile, good movies. Sometimes you got to dig to find them. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. If you rely on the mainstream media, you're not going to even know these things exist.
Yeah.
Although,
as we've talked about many times here, Kansas City is something in a league of its own when it comes to opportunities to see independent films.
We have a whole handful of, for want of a better word, let's call them art houses. That's an umbrella term, with loyal customers who come
right.
back over and over again. Sometimes the movie is secondary to the fact that they're going to the theater they know, they love. They're pretty sure they're going to have a satisfying experience there.
I get a lot of friends who ask me questions about some of the kinds of films we review on this show. I've never had anyone ask me What do you think about the new Mummy with Tom Cruise?
Wait, here's what amazes me when I go to the Tivoli, you know, or 95th and Mission to see one of the films we talk about here so often. What bowls me over time and time again is I never want to miss the previews. And I always tell my wife, come on, we got to hurry and get in here, because the previews are so compelling. And what amazes me so often is that how can a preview be so compelling and the finished product be as bad as it is, you know, over the same preview?
Because a good movie is subtle, and subtle doesn't make for good trailers. Mm-hmm. Oh, the more obvious a movie is, the more blatant, the better stuff you've got for your trailer. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, I've gone to see too many movies where every good moment was in the trailer.
But then, you know, like this
isn't
new,
that the truth?
This new Pirates of the Caribbean opens, which I've heard is just dreadful. And they're all kind of, the critics are kind of going, oh, cross your fingers, please, let this be the last one in the franchise, quote unquote, in the reboot, whatever. I mean, those are words that will keep me away from a theater for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. No idea what's going to be the next Cleopatra to bring the studio system down and, you know, wake them up to what, you know, making good movies again.
I don't know.
But do you see previews and think, man, that looks so good? And then you read about the film when it comes out, and it's like the critic just rakes it. And you're like, how could that be? The preview was so good.
Yeah, I think I'm a little too jaded, you know. I think you can make anything look good in 3 minutes. So, you know, yeah, you put the best parts into it.
You can't make me look good in 3 minutes. It takes a whole lot longer than that. Okay. Well, you all have referred here this morning to this Netflix and what's going on there. There's this controversy at Cannes that has flared this year over streaming films and Netflix. Fill us in on that, Steve. What's going on here?
Well, in a nutshell, and I'm only informed because Beck sent me a great article from IndieWire yesterday. Basically, there's two films premiering at Cannes. One is from Noah Baumbach, a very well-known director, did Squid and the Whale and Margot at the Wedding.
Greenberg.
His next film is going right to Netflix this summer. It's going to bypass distributors, which is both fun for Netflix owners and terrifying for lovers of independent film. And then there's a Korean film. Do you remember the
Okja
is starting on Netflix in late June. Well, the Cannes organizers found this. We can't have this. We have to have movies that will be seen in theaters. But you know what their policy in France is, and correct me if I'm wrong, French films don't go to their streaming services for 36 months. Am I getting that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Think about that. Three years? I mean, we're used to getting movies 8 weeks after they close.
And in theory, can elevate a film and give it attention that if it doesn't have a planned theatrical release, could get at one and get more people to see a good film.
Well, distributors go to Cannes to buy films, too. That's the big talk.
There's some big money at stake, big contracts for distribution.
Yeah. Question. All the films we tend to talk about on this show, art, independent, and foreign films, can you see all those films on Netflix, or is it still a hit-and-miss kind of proposition?
Not eventually Netflix, but, you know.
You know, if you subscribe to, let's say, two streaming services, eventually, you're going to see 90% of the movies we talk about on this show available.
Because sometimes I look on Netflix. I don't have two. I just have Netflix. And you go and you look and you don't find the film.
Well, between that, Amazon and Hulu, there's a very good chance that these are going to be available to you.
And they're not the only ones. I mean, Criterion Collection has a streaming service.
Mm-hmm. They do.
That's pretty much predominantly foreign films.
And so does the BFI.
They
have
the British Film Institute.
And those, I think, are free.
Oh, nice. I didn't know that.
What is the best streaming service out there? If you only had to pick one, where are you going?
I have issues with Amazon, so I only have Netflix, really. I think the problem with the search, though, is the logarithms sometimes aren't so great. So what I tend to do is I subscribe to, IndieWire, things like that, and they usually post what's coming up on Amazon, what's available, because it doesn't always show up in your suggestions. So.
Yeah. Speaking of the logarithms, is that what they're called? I purposely was seeing a lot of TV because I was watching Aziz Ansari's show and Kimmy Schmidt, but they're only sending me like TV shows. And it's like, no, I want to watch movies too. So I purposely this morning went up to search and said Eastern European dark films and did some searches like that so I would get more options. Because you don't see every single thing available when you're strolling on the homepage.
Yeah, online I always get like, you know, independent movie with strong female lead or something. Well, there you go. That's what I want. But when I want something different.
Story of your life.
Yeah.
It's algorithms sometimes, and they don't give you what they
algorithms,
want.
Algorithms, right. Yeah. What did I say?
We talked about that this week on the show.
Mm-hmm. You know, so putting in your own searches, and you know, this is where we can, you know, to push our own agenda, I guess, this is where critics can come in handy, too, you know, when we start talking about more what's streaming and what's available on there.
Because
the great thing about Netflix is also sort of what this article was talking about is kind of a drawback of it, is that it has so many titles.
Yeah.
There's just so much on Netflix that sometimes it can be hard to filter through.
And just a reminder to our listeners, I try to Facebook and Twitter every week. Our critics submit their three to see. If you're confused as to what to go out and see there at kcur.org, we'll post your recommendations for the best films now showing. And that's the idea, to help people navigate this very cluttered landscape.
And one of the, I think my top 10 of the year so far only has four titles on it. One of them premiered on Netflix, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. Still one of the best films I've seen all year.
It's still on Netflix, yeah.
Yeah.
You can still watch that one.
Okay. Well, let's move on here. We're going to talk about a whole series of films. If any of our listeners have seen any of these yet and want to chime in this morning, 816-235-2888 is the number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Beck, let's start with you in a film titled The Lovers. It's about a married couple both having affairs that winds up, interestingly, reinvigorating their romantic life. And this one stars Deborah Winger.
Yeah.
She's back.
It's from a young director named Azazel Jacobs. He had kind of a sort of indie hit a few years ago. I think it was 2011 with this movie called Terry, starring John C. Reilly as a teacher. Turns out Deborah Winger saw this movie, loved it so much that she contacted him and asked him to find something for them to do together.
Hmm.
He sent her a few things, and this is the project that she chose. So it stars Winger and Tracy Letts, who is actually maybe more known for his stage work, August Osage County, and he's won a Pulitzer Prize and some Tony Awards.
Huh.
Married couple. Really not interested in each other, both sort of these boring jobs that they have. They each have lovers on the side. Well, actually, not even on the side. They have a lot, like, the lovers are primary, and they are just waiting for a visit from their son to be done to tell each other that they're going to leave. Although they don't know each other, they don't know that this is going to happen, that they have the same plan.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the plan of it. The way I would describe this movie is probably it's the most French American film that I've ever seen in its treatment of marriage. I think it's really honest and open, and you know, this young director really just lets Winger and Letts kind of breathe. There are many scenes where they're just looking at each other, and they're saying so much with just these looks.
It's funny, but it's not sitcom-y funny. There are some very subtle things going on here. For instance, their respective lovers are two of the neediest people I have ever encountered in a film. You wonder how this married couple, how they could possibly have hooked up with people so, well, maybe not, so diametrically opposed to the person they're married
to. Letts' character has his girlfriend's number listed under work. And she is so much work.
Well, Deborah Winger is making something of a comeback here. She's been away for a few years. Do I understand that right?
She works sporadically. Yeah.
Yeah. And the fact that she's back here and we're talking about her suggests she is an actor of note. I mean, how good is she in this film? How do you regard her as an actress just in general?
I love her. I absolutely love
her. I do too.
And I think she's fabulous in this.
You know, and what makes this so interesting is that at some point you have to ask yourself, to whom do you owe fidelity?
Mm-hmm.
The person you're married to, or your lover? And that's where this becomes a really interesting moral conundrum, a twist, but done humorously. I have to give a certain shout out to the musical score here. There is one bedroom encounter that the music stops just short of breaking into "Love Is a Many Splendored Thing." It was just it was one of the most delicious satirical musical underlinings I've ever seen.
You like Winger?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
What is it about her that has endured longer than so many actresses do? And I'm wondering why.
this is going to sound weird, but I think it's integrity. I just think you feel it coming out of her and the characters she plays.
Right.
I just really feel that. You feel like, and having met her, she, you know, her husband directed a film about 10 years ago, which was shown here at Kansas City as part of the film festival.
He's from here.
Yeah, he's from Independent. Yeah. She was just astonishingly non-Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And I, very, very nice.
And that's
person.
Sort of part of her shtick.
That's sort of,
I mean, that's her thing.
Persona. Yeah,
she's,
yeah.
She's very raw.
Maybe it's not a shtick. Maybe it's really who she is.
She's very raw, and you know, I think the best thing about her is her characters always tend to be looking for to make connections. She's the character in this movie who isn't quite ready to let go of the past, but but she doesn't want to give up the boyfriend either. And you just feel this conflict in her. You know, you just feel this like trying to connect with both these men in her life. That's and it's just a really powerful performance.
So you like this film?
I love this film.
Oh yeah,
the film is titled The Lovers. You liked it, Bob? Yeah,
I didn't see it. So.
Yeah, we're 2 for 2 here with The Lovers. Okay, let's move on to a film that I'd like to see because I remember this fight as a little boy. It's titled Chuck. Bob Butler says it should have been titled The Bleeder. It's a biopic about the Jersey boxer whose bout with Muhammad Ali inspired Sylvester Stallone to create Rocky Balboa.
You know. One of the great pleasures of movie going is watching a movie and saying, wait, this character, I mean, I think I know this actor. And then you realize it's a famous actor who is so sunk into the role that it threw you off. That happens at least 4 or 5 times in this movie with performances by different people. Chuck Wepner was known as the Bayonne Bleeder. He was the kind of guy who says if he couldn't reach his opponent, he'd try to wear him out with his face.
meaning he would, his face would get smacked
around something fierce. In fact, The Bleeder was the original title of Chuck. I wish they'd stuck with it. I think that's fantastic. Anyway, this is not a fight movie per se. It's about how a little nobody got a chance at greatness. He didn't win, but he went for 15 rounds against Ali, which is saying something. Sylvester Stallone in Hollywood looks at this David and Goliath story and says, I can write a screenplay about that. Wow. Rocky as a result. And then it's about the aftermath, about Chuck Wepner, who is just basically a nobody neighborhood guy, and what happens to his life. People assume he has a piece of the Rocky franchise. He got nothing. Huh. He ends up wrestling Andre the Giant and a grizzly bear from Hollywood. This is, you know, he's got a wife played by Elizabeth Moss who basically supports the family. She's fantastic.
Yeah.
He's got a barmaid he's chasing played by Naomi Watts, his Mrs. Schreiber, who I didn't. It was only in her third scene that I went, holy cow, that's Naomi Watts. That's what this movie does to you.
Wow.
You've got Jim Gaffigan as his enabler best friend, one of these hangers-on that's only there to get the famous guy's leftover girlfriends and cocaine. You've got Ron Perlman as his manager. And I'm sitting here going, this is like total immersion in a world, that right. New Jersey ethos, that I'm just loving this.
How's Gaffigan?
Gaffigan... He's
good.
Really good.
Yeah.
You know,
he's been here before.
Great
comedian.
In both his comedy and his TV show, he plays, you know, the kind of doofusy husband. In this case, he's the doofusy best friend.
Hanger on
who lacks all the morality of his of Gaffigan's other characters.
It really does feel like he's acting in this, though, not just making an appearance as Jim Gaffigan.
No,
absolutely.
You don't recognize him.
No, people just, they creep up on you on this.
This is a terrific script. Solid acting all the way through. Immersion, I wrote when I was watching it, committed. Schreiber is committed.
Totally committed. And, you know, this is not a pleasant character necessarily.
No.
He cheats. He, you know, deals drugs. He's...
Yeah.
He has no self-awareness.
He thought the world would just embrace him for eternity. And when he finds out that's not true, I mean, he discovers cocaine, which helps his self-esteem until it wears off. And then... And you had said earlier, it's not a boxing movie at all.
No, this isn't a boxing
movie. So I would
like
to hear what you mean.
And in fact, this is one of those movies that's sort of about movies. It's a boxing movie about boxing movies. You know, he's just enthralled with Requiem for a Heavyweight, the Anthony Quinn. He quotes lines. He watches it nonstop. He, you know, and then that his life was made into Rocky is just sort of this weird postmodern take on you know, sort of boxing movies.
Even when the first Rocky came out, did people recognize this was the Chuck Wepner story? Because I don't really remember that being clear.
That only became clear several years afterwards when people would interview. In fact, there's a scene in here where Stallone offers Wepner a role. He has to audition for a role
for the second
Rocky movie.
Oh my gosh.
Number one, this guy isn't an actor, but two, he shows up with his hanger-on buddy and a couple of bimbos whacked out of his mind. It's a self-destructive cycle this guy's on.
Is that the clip we're going to hear here?
Actually, this is a set in the Ali fight. That's what this clip is all about. So let her rip.
This is from Chuck.
Now it looks like Wepner may possibly have a cut above the eye. I think I see some red stuff that might possibly be hair. No, Wepner is cut above the eye. It looks like a pretty good gash, too. Wepner holds his arms up and says, go on, champ. Is that the best you can do? Wepner's a tough kid. There's no doubt about it. I have tremendous respect for the courage of this man. Ali has no respect for his ability.
All I know is they all said I was going to be done in 3 rounds. And now they're chanting my name. Sure, he was beating the crap out of me. But they loved it. They love me.
Hey, yeah. You hear that crowd, Chuck? They love you, Chuck. They love you.
Wow.
There's some great lines, like one, he's trying to excuse some of his philandering to Elizabeth Moss, his estranged wife, saying, I was hurt. I was feeling bad from all the hits I took. She goes, you want to talk about hurt? Lift 5 minutes in my shoes. Yeah. She's okay. Fantastic.
Yeah. Lots of good feelings about the film Chuck that's showing at the Glenwood Fine Arts Theater. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about this revivalist, A Quiet Passion, Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent, and a whole bunch more. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. Yesterday we learned why Americans are divided over basic issues and why it makes our nation exceptional. Also, the president of Actors Equity makes the case for government funding of the arts. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Up to Date is off on Memorial Day. We'll be back on Tuesday to speak with a teacher who's written about his life living and caring for his wife who is mentally ill. That's Tuesday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour we're visiting with our film critics, talking about some interesting new films now showing. Steve Walker's here, Bob Butler, Beck Ireland. Let's move on, Steve, to The Survivalist. This is following an apocalyptic event. Say that five times fast. A man living off the land is disrupted by a woman and her daughter, Steve.
This came from the 2015 Tribeca Film Festival and came out of nowhere, really. It's playing at Screenland Tapcade, which is their downtown screen. So it opens and you know something's happened. This man's living off the land. He's grungy. His hair's a mess and chopped up and he's wearing rags and setting bear traps, okay? And without really knowing what happened to get the world to that spot, two interlopers show up, a woman and her grown daughter, who kind of want to make a deal with him. They've been out in the world struggling as well, and he doesn't want any part of it until, and I think this is one of the biggest flaws in the movie, he thinks she's sexy. And I'm thinking, in a world where you're...
She being the daughter.
Yeah.
In
a world where you're struggling to get a drop to drink and a bite to eat, A, would sex really come up in the equation? And B, would his Bic lighter still work? Those are my issues with the movie. After 7 years, his Bic lighter just works fine.
Just fine. Okay.
Anyway, maybe I'm being cynical, but
well, there is a graphic in the opening where it talks about a population with, I think, petroleum extract, and so what happens is that petroleum is all dried up, and so that goes away, and the population starts to dwindle, and so this guy, which I assume is somewhere in the
it's Ireland,
Ireland,
You know, I enjoyed this, and in many ways, it's a silent movie. There's almost no dialogue, and I thought they did a very good job of creating this atmosphere of total paranoia. This guy's lived alone for so long, and he's in the first scene you see him dragging a dead body and putting it in his compost pile. Don't waste anything out here. And they never explain who it is that's dead, but you assume it was someone who encroached on his territory. The acting is very really actually pretty understated. I did like it. I didn't dislike it,
but those two things stood out for me.
Yeah,
the Bic lighter working.
I'm not somebody who needs a lot of the answers or explanations or anything, but I do feel like this movie is a lot more atmosphere than it is story.
Yeah,
to me, that didn't quite get it over. I think there's some great photography, though, that one scene. I don't want to give away too much, but they're in a field, and we get sort of an aerial shot to show the positions of where people are, and I think that was just kind of breathtaking.
There's a couple other interlopers that show up as well.
Well, you know what? This reminded me, this isn't Mad Max. This is more The Road.
Mm-hmm. Set in a village, I mean in a forest.
It's in a forest, yeah.
What's the clip?
The clip is the older woman who shows up outside of his cabin and trying to make a deal of what she and her daughter can bring to the table.
This is from The Survivalist.
The real treasure, then. We have legumes, brassicas, strong varieties. These could boost your yield. Surely you can spare something. There's more than enough.
That's what they all thought.
Whoever they is, right? Whoever there's a is. There's a tone that's consistent in this, for sure.
But some mixed reviews here, if I'm hearing you all correctly, on The Survivalist, right?
Mm-hmm. From me, yeah.
Yeah, effective, but not essential.
Effective but not essential. We'll leave it at that. Beck, let's move on to A Quiet Passion. This one intrigues me a little bit. It's Cynthia Nixon of
Sex and the City
fame, yeah, playing poet Emily Dickinson, whose values conflicted with those of her family and the church.
So this is from writer-director Terrence Davies. He has adapted a lot of sort of great novels before. He had The House of Mirth and The Deep Blue Sea. In this movie, he's set out to demystify the myth of the recluse that the poet was. He read that she had, withdrawn from life in her 20s, and he thought that there must be something more to her. And so he follows the lead of the biographer Richard B. Sewell in a 1974 biography of Emily Dickinson, in which he showed that she did, like to dance and laugh and make connections with people, and that, for a while she was, in the world. And the movie sort of follows that arc, where the beginning is very lively, lots of wordplay, lots of, funny quips. She actually was supposedly a very funny person, and he shows that with Cynthia Nixon playing her role, and I think a really great performance.
Yeah, I've heard it's really great.
Right, and then the second part, it's sort of in two acts. So the first part, she's interacting with her family, and she has a friend, and she's doing things, and then he doesn't really give like a one-to-one explanation of sort of her withdrawal to her room upstairs in their house in Amherst. He sort of alludes that it might be, the death of her father, or, just some things happening. She was diagnosed with Bright's disease, the kidney disease, later, right. So she was experiencing a lot of pain. So the first act is very lively and full of puns, and then the second act is mostly her just kind of berating people.
Just from reading about this is a slow-moving film.
It has a very long arc.
Is it too slow?
I don't think so.
I thought the second part was a little lengthy. Yeah,
I would go along, but that's when you really start to get the performance comes through in that second part. So your patience is rewarded.
She is such an enigma, this character of Emily Dickinson, because she's living in a very provincial time, a proper time and a religious time. And she starts as a kid. She refuses to kowtow to the
prevailing faith.
Right, the prevailing faith, bow down to God in class. We do it every, she goes, no, I'm not going to do it.
She gets kicked out of Mount Holyoke, and they ask her, was it something wrong? Did she have an ailment or something? And she said she was suffering from an acute case of evangelism. She's dealing with these Protestants.
She fights the church. Yeah. She fights her father, who's also quite religious.
And played very well by David Carradine.
Keith Carradine,
yes.
She finds solace in her sister, who's played by Jennifer Ely, who's a Tony Award-winning actress. And there's some great lines in this, too. I mean, she says, she quips, and she's very self-deprecating, and she said, I would be a kangaroo amongst the beauties. So is her excuse for not going somewhere. And she is kind of housebound a little bit, mm-hmm. right?
It's funny. This isn't a literary biography, really, although Nixon does read from some of the poems.
Definitely.
But, During her lifetime, Emily Dickinson had maybe a dozen poems published in regional newspapers. It wasn't until well after her death that her poems were collected.
Is that right? Yeah.
And she's had sort of a Van Gogh type of, you know.
Yeah.
And toward the end of her life, you get a sense of the bitterness and maybe just a touch of madness coming through
A very sharp wit, deep feelings.
What's the clip we have from A Quiet Passion, Beck?
I believe this is when she invites a new pastor and his wife over for tea, and they get into a very lively discussion about religious views.
This is from A Quiet Passion.
And you, Miss Dickinson, what of you?
What of me, sir?
Will you not kneel and give yourself to God?
No, sir, I will not kneel. Though I think that God has already given himself to me.
That was profane.
It was not meant so, sir.
Do you guard your soul, Emily?
As best as I am able, sir.
And hell? What of hell?
Avoid it if I can. Endure it if I must.
That was irreligious, young lady.
Then I beg God's pardon for my impiety.
Wow. Okay.
It's a little...
little
it
stagey.
May sound a little stilted, a little bit, but Nixon pulls it off. So
yeah, that delivery is part of it, the charm, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about the last time with the Cezanne and the Cezanne movie about, you know, sort of historical accuracy, that really gives it the feel like these are conversations that these people may have had then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, that film again is the Emily Dickinson biopic of sorts, A Quiet Passion. Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking with our art, independent, and foreign film critics about some good films showing for this glorious, long Memorial Day weekend coming up here. Steve, let's move on to Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent. This is a documentary about the chef whose innovative ideas about local ingredients in American cuisine changed the food world.
Well, I consider myself pretty well-versed in the restaurant scene and in chefs.
And I consider Ruth, you to be that way, too.
Ruth, thank
yes,
you.
Yes.
My clothes exhibit number one.
Yeah.
But Ruth Reichel, who's been on your program, she was the former restaurant critic for the New York Times, she shows up a lot in this movie. Jeremiah Tower, I'd never heard of him. Which amazed me.
I feel better now because I hadn't either.
Well, I hadn't. And then once you get into his story, there's reasons why that is that are pretty complicated. His first real connection to restaurants was to Chez Panisse, which our foodie listeners will know is Alice Waters' restaurant in San Francisco.
It's actually in Berkeley.
Oh, it's Berkeley. Okay. So they collaborated for a while. He was her head chef. Then something happens, I won't spoil it, that separates them and estranges them. And then he opens Stars in San Francisco, which is a huge hit.
Mm-hmm.
The Cafe Society to punk rockers to drag queens. I mean, it hosted everybody and made everybody feel welcome. And then he sort of disappeared.
Hmm.
Self-imposed exile for over a decade and ended up at the Tavern on the Green, which
is where chefs go to die, I
which
guess.
Is a bittersweet coda. Yeah, Tavern on the Green is nothing but a big tourist trap. I mean, I've eaten there myself twice, I think, and I don't remember what I ate. I mean, but that didn't go well. So, but he's had a very interesting life. He was raised around incredible privilege, but he was so neglected by his rich hobnobbing parents.
There is a great story about his parents having cocktails one night and being amazed to see young Jeremiah come down the stairs because each parent thought the other had sent him off to boarding school several months earlier.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Incredible.
One of the themes that runs through this is that he is an enigma. Even people who claim to be close to him say, you don't know, you can't know this man. And you wonder if that childhood didn't sort of inure him to lasting relationships.
Yeah, this is really a fascinating psychological portrait, and I was just kind of amazed at his openness to talking about this, because people have known him 30, 40 years were saying that he never talks about these things. Yeah.
And here he is talking to a documentary filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
What's the clip
we have
here
a clip
from Jeremiah
of
Tower?
Various people talking about Stars at its height, including, we start with Wolfgang Puck.
This is from Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent.
Everybody who was somebody who came to San Francisco had to go to Stars, and Jeremiah knew all of them.
The great socialite Denise Hale was throwing incredible parties there. I mean, very highfalutin, fancy dinner parties, night after night after night.
But of course, she brought in a large amount of business, because if Denise was there every night, everybody else had to be there every night.
Countess of Yugoslavia, Baryshnikov.
Sophia Loren there, Pavarotti was there, all the people in the opera world.
A lot of the politicians would come over from City Hall or the chief of police, and they would be there at 8 or 9 in the morning having a beer.
Gorbachev. I cooked dinner for Gorbachev.
Run DMC and the Beastie Boys and their entourage come in and had everybody just going crazy. We didn't mind having punk rockers there. We didn't mind having spiked-haired people there. We didn't mind having, you know, the elite of the elite there, because everybody had their position in the restaurant.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it's really, really good. Yeah, it's. I really loved it.
Okay, great reviews for Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent. Okay, here's a film that intrigues me a little bit. It's titled Norman, Bob Butler. It's Richard Gere playing a New York fixer whose financial wheelings and dealings never seem quite to come to fruition.
Yeah, this is sort of a tragedy about a minor player. Richard Gere, over the last few years, the former pretty boy has become, I think, a pretty good actor. Here he plays Norman Oppenheimer, a man who's in his late 60s, apparently unmarried. And he's the kind of guy who will stalk, who will sneak into parties, who will do anything. He dresses well, but that's all a sham. He has no money. He has no office. He does everything on the cell phone. He drops names like nobody's business. But whether any of this is true or not, we don't know. The movie is by Joseph Seder, who wrote and directed it, and it centers on Norman's befriending of a minor Israeli diplomat who has come to the Big Apple. Hmm. This guy's played by Lior Ashkenazi, and he's absolutely terrific. He takes him shopping. He takes his Israeli shopping and buys him the most expensive pair of shoes known to humankind. And of course, Norman, how he's going to pay for this is anybody's guess. But 3 years later, this underling of the Israeli bureaucracy is elected prime minister. And suddenly, Norman, the man who the big wheelers and dealers have shunned for years and, you know, shoot him out of their presence, he has contacts in the highest echelons of, you know, of Israeli life. And now he's poised, to make the deal of a lifetime.
Hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I won't tell you whether it works out or not, but I enjoyed this movie quite a bit because I found myself rooting for this guy, even as I realized that he is such a bottom feeder and a minor smart player.
Yeah.
His sheer ambition and you feel sorry for the desperation. Always beneath that polished surface, you can see a furtive individual.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's actually kind of a troubling movie. Well, it was for me anyway, just because everything that Norman is doing is basically either really unethical or even illegal. So it sets up kind of it's a pyramid scheme of favors that he's asking for. For me, he's just kind of a guy that you just don't want to spend any time with, even, you know, on the screen, really. There were a few moments that I thought were really great in the movie where you do for him after the man he's bought the shoes for becomes the Israeli prime minister. There's this moment where, like, almost time stops when you're watching the movie, whether or not he's going to recognize him and acknowledge their relationship. And I won't say what happens, but, you know, that had me, you know, forgetting my pain for a second.
Oh, her pain.
But otherwise,
we've got a clip here, which is
Gere and Buscemi.
Yeah, Steve Buscemi plays the rabbi at Norman's synagogue. And ironically, Norman visits synagogue a lot because he doesn't have any place else to go. Everybody thinks he's a big wheeler dealer in the synagogue, and they put him in charge of fundraising campaigns so they can buy the city block on which the synagogue sits.
This is from Norman.
Rabbi, it's Norman.
I know, I've been calling you all morning. Why don't you answer your phone?
I'm answering now. You want to hear what I have to say?
Yeah, you spoke to him? What did he say?
Let's just say, get ready for a big surprise.
How many zeros are at the end of the surprise? Can you tell me that at least?
Come on. A considerable surprise. That's it. I gotta go, Rabbi.
No, Norman, you realize how important this is, right? We are gonna be kicked out of here. You need to give us a firm answer. No games, Norman.
Hold on.
No time for...
I can't hear a word you're saying. Norman.
God damn it.
How is the rabbi connected to this again, Norman?
Remind me. Why am I doing this?
Do you want Rabbi Blumenthal to marry you or not? All you have to do is you pick up the phone, call one of your buddies at Harvard on behalf of the Prime Minister of Israel. Is that really so difficult for you?
Don't belittle what I'm doing, okay? In the world of Harvard admissions, this is the biggest no-no in the book. It's like incest. It's taboo.
That's funny, because Rabbi Blumenthal is going to think exactly the same thing when he finds out I'm asking him to marry a Cohen and a convert who isn't even officially converted.
That's from Norman. Richard
he's making
Gere.
Deals all over the place, none of which he can back up.
Hardly any, and I didn't care for this movie much. I will say that Gere is effective at making you feel sorry for him because everybody kind of shuns him. It's like that person at your work site, not here necessarily, but who you see coming down the hall and make a quick right because you don't want to even have an encounter with them. Yikes. I mean, that kind of sense of his
yeah,
character.
I really wish they'd shown the clip where he meets Charlotte Gainsbourg because that gives you much, much more an idea about that. She plays a woman who works at the consulate as a lawyer, and it's actually his trying to do her a favor in sort of the same way that he tries to do everyone a favor that becomes his biggest problem.
Mm. Okay. That's, again, Norman. We just have a few minutes left, gang. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Gifted Steve Walker. It's a mathematically brilliant little girl. She becomes the center of a custody battle between her grandmother and the uncle who's raised her to be a normal kid. Quotes around normal.
Well, this didn't make the cut last month because we ran out of time, and it's still playing on area screens. It's a Fox Searchlight production, which is why we're having it on this show. It stars Chris Evans, who I realized I hadn't seen him on screen in many, many, many years because he only makes Avengers movies, which I don't see. And he does an okay job. He plays the uncle of this little girl. Her mother has ended her life, and he's kind of adopted her, and he's realizing she's getting to school age. She cannot continue with his limited ability to educate her because it's clear that she's brilliant at certain kinds of math. And so she goes to public school. They see it too. And he meets Jenny Slate, who I love, who was the girl's teacher. And he and Chris Evans and her have kind of an relationship. this was directed by Mark Webb, who did 500 Days of Summer and other independent films before he went into the Spider-Man franchise, right? It's an effective film. And I think the little girl, her name is McKenna Gray. She's 11. Is okay, and her late mother's mother, Lindsay Duncan, is overbearing, very rich, very privileged, and has all the resources to fight Chris Evans, who wants to keep custody of her. Mm.
Okay.
That's how it unfolds. I'm not sure if we
have a clip, yes.
Oh, we do have a clip. She's talking about how she just finds public school distasteful.
Okay, this is from Gifted.
I didn't want to go to this stupid school in the first place. And the boy in the next row acts inappropriately for someone who's a child.
I'm sorry, I'm still passive-aggressively ignoring you.
Other kids answer questions, they don't get into trouble.
You didn't get in trouble for answering questions. You yelled at the principal. Oh, you know what? You're gonna find this interesting. So I Googled first graders who yell at the principal, and statistically, you're never gonna believe how many kids do it.
How many?
None.
What'd you think of this film, Bob?
I didn't see it. Sorry.
Oh, you didn't see it.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
I thought you said it.
Yeah. I did. I was wrong.
No.
Too many films.
I just felt I'd seen it.
But someone's Walker, going. I did like it. People are going. It's been around for almost 3 months and still showing up on people's radar.
Beck, let's get to the zookeeper's wife. This is the keepers of a zoo in Warsaw, Poland, harbor hundreds of Jews in their facility during the German invasion. And I like this film. Yeah.
Yeah, this is based off of a 2007 best-selling nonfiction book. So it's based, you know, off a true story about a zookeeper couple who go to the ghetto and under the premise of, you know, getting scraps for their pigs. They've converted the zoo into a pig farm, and they smuggle people out of the ghetto into their facility, and they, transport them someplace safe, or some of them stayed throughout almost the whole duration of the war in the zoo.
Yeah. Who stars in this film?
Jessica Chastain is the zookeeper's wife.
Yeah.
And I think...
Who's pretty good.
Yeah, she's fabulous. And sort of her, the opponent of it all is the German actor Daniel Brühl. Mm-hmm. And I think she has to sort of pretend that she likes him, that she's interested in him. And they're sort of a strange sort of love triangle, love-hate triangle, because right. she hates him, but she has to keep this pretense up, which makes her husband jealous, which right. is, you know, sort of an interesting dynamic.
What's the clip we have here?
I believe this is the time when the idea to bring people into the zoo is first introduced.
Okay, from the zookeeper's wife.
There are people I know, people trying to help. They have trucks, they have guns, and they want to use the zoo as a way station.
What do you mean?
A place to hide Jews until safe houses can be found for them.
A friend is different. One friend. But more than one. It's dangerous, Jan. You said it yourself.
They're starving, Antonina. 2 kilometers away, they're trapped and starving like rats in a cellar.
That's from The Zookeeper's Wife. Okay, we ran through quite a list of films here. Steve, if you just had 3 to see this weekend, what would
you
pick?
I do. Chuck and Jeremiah Tower both open today, and A Quiet Passion.
Okay, yeah, the Emily Dickinson film, yeah. Beck?
The Lovers, Jeremiah Tower, and Chuck.
And Chuck, the Wepner film scoring 2 for 2. Bob?
Lovers, Quiet Passion, and Chuck.
Okay, wow. So Emily Dickinson, Chuck Wepner, and...
Two very similar characters, Chuck Wepner and Emily Dickinson.
Well, Chuck does write poetry to his wife.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, sort of the end, Emily gets a little feisty.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all very much. That's Bob Butler, Steve Walker, Beck Ireland. Appreciate the good conversation here. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Monday, we're off, but Tuesday, we'll talk about some good stuff going on here. What are we talking about Tuesday? I can't. It's not here. But we want to thank all the men and women of the armed forces who have served and are serving our country. That's right. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.